This is Brian Cambria with news for the KVNF listening area, Tuesday, June 19, 2012. The High Park Fire west of Fort Collins has burned more than 58,000 acres and is about 50% contained. The Denver Post reports that even with lighter than predicted winds yesterday, extreme heat and low humidity combined to stoke the wildfire, creating difficult and even more potentially dangerous conditions for firefighters. Firefighters took advantage of the lighter winds to improve and extend their fire line and work to secure and protect structures that remain threatened. The fire has crossed the Cache-la-Poudre River in two places and continues to burn and threaten unburned islands within the fire perimeter. Fire managers are reporting that so far the fire has cost about $14.7 million to fight. Hugh Carson is the Deputy Air Operations Branch Director on the High Park Fire and also a KVNF DJ. Carson is responsible for aviation assets, strategy, and tactics on this fire. KVNF's Ariana Brocious spoke with Carson yesterday about his operations so far.
Hugh, can you give us an idea of what it's like there on the ground from your perspective?
Believe me, I've been doing this for 41 years, and this is probably the most challenging incident aviation-wise that I've been on, and it's a result of several factors. One is the sheer number of aircraft. When I got here the early morning of June 10th, they had approximately six aircraft on the fire, and it was my responsibility to order sufficient aircraft to meet the need, and we went from six to 34 aircraft in less than 36 hours. So my workload has been very high for about 9 days straight, and that's why this fire has been the most challenging I've ever encountered. I am ground-based at what's called the Incident Command Post for the Incident Management Team. I have two main positions that work for me. One is the Air Tactical Group Supervisor, who is commonly in a fixed-wing aircraft approximately 3,000 to 4,000 feet above ground level. And that individual is responsible for directing the fixed-wing air tankers and the helicopter drops that are being made on the fire. The other individual that I have is called an air support group supervisor, who is responsible for supporting the rotary wing, i.e. helicopter bases, of which we have two on this incident. The main base out here by the National Guard Armory currently has 17 helicopters lined up on an old airstrip. Now, an indicator of the complexity of the air operation on this is instead of one air tactical group supervisor, I have four, each with his or her own fixed-wing aircraft. And I have three air support group supervisors, all pursuing various lines of effort in support of the helicopter show.
Wow. The word is that they've grounded the air support because of high winds. What does that mean for you?
Well, let's back up to Saturday. Things were looking really good as far as having containment on parts of the fire that were critical, i.e. near subdivisions, etc. But we knew what the weather forecast was for yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And very extreme wind events are forecasted. Yesterday at 10 o'clock on the fire, it was blowing 50 miles an hour. So they were grounded for about, I'd say, approximately 5 hours. We were able to get an air tactical aircraft up there to see what had happened, and we immediately put five of our Type 1 sky cranes. Those are the ones that look like praying mantises and hold 2,000 gallons. Today, I really don't have a handle, but you've got the predictions for red flag warnings for extremely high winds. And the other kicker is extremely low single-digit relative humidities, both of which very, very much affect fire progression.
And so How is the fire management going? Are you making progress?
We always make progress. We suffer setbacks now and then, is a good way to put it. It's a physical environment and it's a people environment that we have to deal with.
Are there any predictions thus far as to when this fire might be more contained or sort of calmed down?
I couldn't speak to that. That you would have to talk to our public information office. One thing I'd like to add for all our listeners out there is that I fought fires in Southern California, I fought fires in Alaska, I fought fires in Florida. The situation in Colorado this year is the most explosive in terms of potential that I have ever seen in 41 years. I encourage everybody to take a good hard look at their residences and go online and check out all the things our local fire chiefs have been saying about fireproofing the area surrounding your home. The Wake Fire can happen again very easily this summer.
Thanks a lot, Hugh.
My pleasure.
For those who aren't aware, in 1994, the lightning-sparked Wake Fire burned more than 3,800 acres of pinyon juniper about 4 miles northeast of Hotchkiss on Wakefield Mesa, melting KVNF's transmitter tower as well. Weather conditions are also making it difficult for firefighters to battle the Springer Fire, located in the mountains west of Colorado Springs. As of yesterday evening, the burn area was just shy of 1,000 acres and had more than doubled in size since yesterday morning. Fire Information Officer Bob Dierberg says the fire started under difficult conditions.
As you know, Colorado is one of its worst droughts in 10 years. This ignition happened under a high wind period with very low fuel moistures, low humidity, took off quite a bit. We've been hitting it hard with resources, but our intention is to put all the effort into it as possible to develop containment and suppression.
No structures have been reported damaged or destroyed, and no injuries. Mandatory evacuations are in effect in areas near the fire and roads closed. The Colorado Springs Gazette reports fire officials began investigating rumors of how the fire began Sunday morning. Park County Sheriff Fred Wegener said an explosion is being investigated as a possible cause of the blaze, but investigators are also looking into whether lightning on Saturday night could be to blame. The manager at the Indian Paintbrush Ranch, who did not want her name used, told the Gazette that she and 10 others were horseback riding Sunday when they heard gunshots and an explosion, then saw flames rise from some brush. The manager said a few of the riders reported seeing a truck with two men leaving the area just after the flames ignited. She said investigators visited the ranch just before 11 a.m. yesterday. Colorado and New Mexico are not the only states with fires. The National Weather Service said smoke from the 22,000-acre Shell Fire north of Ely, Nevada, drifted across Utah and into western Colorado valleys on Monday morning. If you're looking for up-to-date fire information on the web, you can go to www.inciweb.org. That's inciweb.org. San Miguel Power Association members voted out two incumbents in last week's board election. The Telluride Daily Planet reports that challenger Doyleen Garvey beat Ken Barnes for District 1. In District 4, Jack Sibbold beat Michael Saftler. Barnes and Saftler had both served on the board since 2008. District 1 includes the towns of Nucla, Naderita, and Redvale, western Montrose and San Miguel counties, and part of Dolores County. District 4 includes Sawpit and Telluride, west of South Tomboy Road. SMPA Board of Directors' terms are for 4 years. Sibbold told the Planet that his win came as a complete surprise. New board members will be sworn in at today's board meeting. The Norwood Food Bank has moved east of town to its own building. The Norwood Post reports that the building, a three-bedroom home that has stood vacant for a year, was donated by San Miguel County. The food bank has been located in the back of the Abundant Life Church for the past 2 years. Food Bank volunteer manager Skeeter Jones told the Post, quote, "This is just awesome. The county really stepped up to the plate, and we now have room to grow if we need to." The new location is east of Norwood, near the San Miguel County Road and Bridge property. Norwood Food Bank distribution is every Thursday from 1 until 3 p.m. or by appointment. The Norwood Food Bank is made possible by donations from Angel Baskets and is open to anyone needing the food. There are no income guidelines or residency requirements. And finally, Imogene Pass is open at one of the earliest dates in recent history. Or is that Imogene? Excuse me. The Telluride Watch reports that mild weather conditions paired with light snowpack allowed San Miguel County equipment operators to reach the top of the pass from the Telluride side around June 4th. Ouray County equipment operators finished by Thursday, June 7th, and reported that the first travelers of the season made the full trip over the pass later that day. Imogene Pass, at more than 13,000 feet, is the second highest mountain pass in Colorado that you can drive over. It is uncommon for the popular route to open before July. Local tour operators say that the early accessibility of high country roads this year has been a definite bonus for business. This concludes the morning newscast. For KVNF News, I'm Brian Cambria.